Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM, Troy, New York, WOOS 98.9 FM, Schenectady, New York, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm your host, H. Bosch Jr.
And I'm Amy Loria. Today we start out with part two of Mark Dunlay's piece on the New York State Legislature's hearings to divest the state pension funds from fossil fuels.
Next, yours truly with the Triple E's segment, featuring Zanelle Fish and Ada Harper discussing the weekend's upcoming Waking Up White seminar in the Troy, New York YWCA.
Later on, our roaming labor correspondent, Willie Terry, speaks with Newark Mayor Roz J. Baraka in part two of his segment, Labor Talk, from the National Town Meeting on Gentrification in Newark, April 4 through 6.
All right. After that, the latest installment of Imani Taylor's technology series features an interview with retired architect Joe Famia.
Finally, correspondent Paul Smart recently attended poet Sam Truitt's seminar at the North Albany Public Library. Bosch, did you know that poetry has been used to fight cyborgs?
Oh, wow.
Let's start the show with some headlines.
Okay. I think we have this. According to Winnie, yes, New York State Senator Tom O'Meara announced he will honor a longtime stalwart of civil affairs in the city of Hornell in the Canonisto Valley. Say that again. Canonisto Valley. As he's the 2019 State Senate Woman of Distinction, Pauline Polly Holbrook will represent the 58th District in the Senate's 21st Annual Women of Distinctions Award ceremony on Tuesday, May 7th in the Legislative Office Building in Albany. She will be joined by more than 60 other honorees representing the districts throughout New York.
The New York State Senate held a hearing this morning on proposals to strengthen regulations for limos and buses following last year's deadly limo crash in Schoharie. Proposals requiring seatbelts, airbags, and escape hatches in limos have become a major sticking point. News 10 Albany is reporting that many activists, including families of the victims of the Schoharie crash, simply want to crack down on inspections. The limo involved in the Schoharie crash had failed inspections multiple times but was still on the road. Activists want to change that, ensuring that any limo that fails inspection either be repaired immediately or be booted. They are also calling for a requirement that limo drivers carry CDL licenses.
Okay. Mary Janine Packer wants to tag along with the industrial hemp grown at SUNY Morrisville goes to Poland for processing. Packer, president of the Battenkill Fibers in Washington County, is interested in seeing the machines that break down to the plant's sturdy stalks into usable materials in the hopes of someday incorporating a used one into her carding and spinning mill. Battenkill's fiber takes in all kinds of fleece, sheep, lima, alpaca, goat, rabbit, and processing it into various blends, colors, and weights of yam. Equipment at Battenkill Fibers that stretches and aligns fibers for spinning can blend an already processed industrial hemp, which adds strength and luster to the yam. Packer says she now has to buy the hemp silver from overseas. Packer also hopes to be the first to offer locally sourced hemp-infused products to meet the growing demand.
The Enchanted City steampunk-themed festival, usually held on an early autumn Saturday in Troy, might move to another location if organizers cannot resolve issues of money and logistics, says the Time Union. Beyond money, timing and space are also problematic, with both Festival and Troy Waterfront Farmers Market competing for space in Monument Square, as well as the attention of several thousand pedestrians who flock to the city on Saturday mornings. With a history steeped in 19th century industry, Troy is a natural fit for steampunk, a literary and fashion aesthetic that blends the Victorian era with science fiction. In lieu of the Troy location, Dunkel has considered Schenectady, Glens Falls, and even Lansingburg.
Rensselaer Polynetic Institute, better known as RPI, all right, yes, is instituting a mandatory, how about this, summer session for students who have completed their sophomore years, known as the ARC. The summer session is a growing trend, higher education institution that aims to bring a heightened academic focus to students halfway through their undergraduate careers. The second part of the program carries into the junior year, in which students will take their first or second semester away from the campus, either at the internship or the conducting a personal research or other such projects. Additionally, students must live in the dorms during this mandatory summer session. Boy, that's going to be something. More and more colleges and universities are viewing their dormitories as potential income sources that all too often lie dormant during the summer season. Okay, yes. Oh, yes. And Greek supporters and landlords aren't happy about the move. They are shifting that revenue away from the Greeks and shifting it back to the school, and said Brian Littman, an alumni and supporter of the Greek life. Tuition, room, and board are the same as they would be for traditional semesters, the school said. The total varies depending on which housing and meal plan options are picked.
For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
To learn more about the program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or just warm regards, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org.
On April 30th, the New York State Legislature held a hearing on the legislation to divest New York State pension funds from fossil fuels. In today's part two, we hear from Rachel Rivera of New York Communities for Change, Reverend Ken Scott of Green Faith, and Daniel Zerilli, climate change advisor for New York City's mayor's office. Hudson Mohawk Radio Network correspondent Mark Dunley reports.
On Tuesday, April 30th, the New York State Legislature held a hearing as to whether or not the state should divest its pension fund from fossil fuels. We'll be hearing from Reverend Ken Scott of Green Faith, Daniel Zerilli of the New York City Mayor's Office. But first we hear from Rachel Rivera of New York Communities for Change.
We fight for economic and social justice. I am here because of Sandy. I was home when Sandy hit. I heard a cracking sound from my roof. I got scared and I got my daughter out of her bed. As soon as I got her out of the bed, my ceiling caved in onto her bed. We ran into the night with nothing. We lost everything. Possessions, pets, our home. Still to this day, my daughter Marisol has PTSD. When it rains, she can get extremely anxious. Sometimes she's hospitalized. Sandy was bad enough. Then Maria hits Puerto Rico. My mother and my aunt and other family members lost everything, including their homes. A family friend of ours was found dead days later. These disasters are the climate crisis. They are getting worse because sea levels are rising. The seas are getting hotter, and the air carries more water vapors. That makes hurricanes stronger and causes more rains and flooding. Communities of color and low-income people get hurt the worst. We don't have good health care coverage, or family wealth. We can't afford to run our ACs all day during extreme heat waves. We don't have the wealth and power to make it a little easier to bounce back. I know better than most of us, New York State is in grave danger. Cities like New York will drown while baking in heat waves and getting hit by more extreme weather than even Sandy. No place in our state will be spared. Large numbers of New Yorkers will be hit, like my family. Now I heard the controlled argument against divestment. That makes me angry and sad. First of all, don't have public money to corporations like Exxon to help stop climate change. To survivors like me, asking them pretty please to be more better is a sick joke. Their core business model involves destroying our state. You can't get Exxon management to turn into a solo of wind company. In fact, after decades of these pretty pleas from Comptroller DiNapoli, the corporation spends even more on the capital spending on fossil fuels than they had used to. Meanwhile, the oil company CEO laughs all the way to the bank as New Yorkers hands them pension money, even though oil and gas stocks do worse. Our research director did a sample comparison, the S&P 500 versus the oil and gas company. Everyone shows that the fossil fuel companies do worse than the stock market. But that's not my main point. It's really the question of integrity of the comptroller and the state. How can he justify putting public money into investments whose business models destroy the state?
Next, we hear from Reverend Ken Scott, the New York Capital Region organizer for Green Phase.
As people living in the current oil age, every day we fail to transition away from fossil fuel energy. The driving force behind the last four warmest years on Earth ever is another day we sacrifice the two greatest gifts we possess as people, our common home, the Earth, and two, the future of our children and grandchildren. I no longer have the luxury of advancing this cause from a noble yet detached position. For me, it's become personal. Since 2006, I've organized service trips to New Orleans. We go to the Lower Ninth Ward, a historic low-income African-American community made infamous by the images of people stranded on roofs. 15 years later, families are still slowly coming home to the neighborhood, but more are not. They are resettled in cities like Memphis, Houston, and Atlanta, America's first environmental refugees. I've met families in the Lower Ninth who have lost loved ones, lost savings to contractor fraud, and are still trying to rebuild all these years later. Katrina was a glimpse of the future. In November 2011, I spent a day with students down in New York City to assist those hit by Hurricane Sandy. The ministry response team in Brooklyn, I was assigned to, they asked us to deliver coats, hats, gloves, and mittens to seniors in a Coney Island housing unit that was without power. We drove through traffic lights that were out, saw hundreds of takeout meals getting cold inside an unheated church sanctuary, past small mountains of donated clothes piling up on street corners. Inside the freezing damp apartment building, we saw shivering elderly folks huddled in front of their ovens trying to keep warm. We glimpsed the future. 2 weeks after Hurricane Maria, as an act of ministerial care, I hosted dinner for students who had families in Puerto Rico. Some had lost contact with family members. Some had family members whose homes were destroyed, their health and safety threatened. Maria was one of three supersized storms that season, preceded by Harvey in Houston and Irma in Florida, three of the costliest five hurricanes in our history, spawned by warmer ocean temperatures. A glimpse of the future. In 2017, I visited my one-year-old grandson living in Seattle. The week I was there, the city was awash in a pungent, dirty yellow smog wafting in from the huge wildfires of British Columbia. The next year, my daughter in Oakland, California, sent me a photo of my other grandson, not yet two, sitting in his car seat with an air filtration mask on because of the smoke from the devastating Santa Rosa wildfire, which had swirled back in from the Pacific into the Bay Area. This is a glimpse of the future. Bring New York State into the global coalition of institutions that divest.
Our third segment is Daniel Zarelli, who is the Chief Climate Policy Advisor, Office of New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio. The city has indicated that it is going to divest from fossil fuels.
And finally, New York City is bringing this fight straight to the fossil fuel companies that caused this climate crisis in the first place. Let's talk plainly. The burning of fossil fuels is the single largest contributor to human-caused climate change. This simple fact was denied and buried for decades by fossil fuel companies intent on misleading policymakers and the public. Now, New York City is seeking to end this decades-long pattern of deception and denial by holding these fossil fuel companies to account for the damage they've caused while taking prudent steps to protect the financial interests of New Yorkers. In January of 2018, New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio and other pension trustees committed to begin divesting our pension funds from fossil fuel reserve owners, those companies that own the oil and gas in the ground. This is a case where the prudent action to protect city pensions also lines up perfectly with good social policy to fight climate change. Fossil fuel securities have consistently underperformed the market in recent years, and the outlook for fossil fuel investments continues to be poor. And it's important to note that the actions that cities like New York and many others are taking to reduce greenhouse gas emissions will have a long-term impact on our nation's and the world's reliance on fossil fuels. We have a fiduciary obligation to understand the impact these changes will have on pension investments in fossil fuel reserve owners and recognize the true nature of the potential for stranded assets as we all work to achieve the Paris Agreement. According to our most recent analysis, the city's five pension funds hold roughly $5 billion in securities of over 100 fossil fuel reserve owners. Working hand-in-hand with the city comptroller, the pension fund's investment advisor, New York City's pension fund trustees are pursuing divestment consistent with prudent practice and certainly in line with our fiduciary responsibility. This move is among the most significant divestment efforts in the world to date, and along with others, is already being noticed by fossil fuel companies who have remarked in annual reports on the material threat that the divestment movement could have on their ability to secure financing. In order to build on this momentum and facilitate the ability of global cities to share best practices regarding divestment, New York City is a co-leader with London of the Divest Invest Forum, sponsored by the C40's Climate Leadership Group. The objective is to bring city leaders, pension fund managers, asset managers, investment consultants, and other stakeholders together for events, workshops, and dialogue that showcase how the two leading financial centers of the world are divesting from fossil fuels and will foster dialogue and debate among other interested cities on the challenges and approaches so that they too can shift their money towards low-carbon, sustainable investments. And most recently, the New York City pension funds also announced a commitment to double their investments into climate solutions to $4 billion. Combined with divestment, the New York City pension funds are leveraging their assets to help create the solar, wind, and energy efficiency solutions that we so vitally need and securing the retirements of New York City workers at the same time. The good news is that New Yorkers don't wait for others when a challenge arises. We step up and lead, and that's what New York City is doing, and we hope the state has the opportunity to do as well.
Okay. That was correspondent Mike Dunley reporting on the New York State legislative divestment hearings.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM Troy and WOOS 98.9 FM Schenectady. The highlight of our Thursday is upon us, my valiant co-host, Mrs. Bosch's baby boy himself, H. Bosch Jr., serves up another inspirational segment of Triple E's, Education, Entrepreneurship, and Empowerment. This week, we offer you part one of his segment with Zanelle Fish and Ada Harper, in which she discusses this weekend's upcoming Waking Up White seminar at the YWCA in Troy.
Hello again, everyone. This is H. Bosch, Jr. of the Triple E segment, Education, Empowerment, Entrepreneurship. Today's guest is Ms. Zanelle Fish. She's been a producer of arts, programming, film events, performance in Troy for almost 20 years. And also, we have my very good friend, Ms. Ada Harper. She is a freelance social media marketer and a creator of 518 Black, a resource for events happening in, by, and for the Capital Region's Black community. She's also a board member with the local non-for-profit Youth FX, a founding member of the Capital District Intersectional Feminist Group. Welcome, ladies.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Well, hey, thank you so much for taking time out your busy schedule. We knew that this has been a lot of moving parts to make this work, but we're here, and let's dig right in. So tell me a little bit about the Capital District Intersectional Feminist Group. I'll start with you, Ms. Harper.
Hey. Well, I'm happy to be a founding member of it. It stands for Capital District Intersectional Feminists, and we're essentially a collective of women and non-male identified femmes who create intentional community and provide social justice education to the Capital Region.
Oh, okay, okay. So the intersectionality team created by, okay, you know, don't ask me to say that five times fast.
Yes, that is. Say that five times fast. The word intersectionality. Intersectionality. All right. And I thought I would take the time to let people know what that is, because that's a somewhat new word for many people with learning about social justice. Essentially, it is a term created by a Black femme legal scholar named Kimberly Crenshaw in 1989. And it's used to describe the ways in which oppressive institutions like racism, classism, and sexism are connected and cannot be examined separately from one another.
Okay. What about the CDIF's core project? I understand it's Books and Breakfast.
Yes. We essentially started something called Books and Breakfast, and it's a way to build intentional community with members of the Capital Region. Essentially, it's very simple. We have accumulated a mass of donated books, which we lay out on tables, books for children and adults, and we also provide a meal, which is the breakfast.
Okay.
And it's just a way to casually engage with people that we wouldn't otherwise engage with, because in honesty, technology and distances have separated people, even living right next to each other. And so we were just like, hey, what's a way we can create community with people that are feeling isolated and disconnected from their communities? And so we started Books and Breakfast, and it essentially went back to what the Black Panthers did, which started with the breakfast programs in schools.
Mm-hmm. And how's the community involvement been with that?
Great. It's been a steady climb. We've done, I believe, like 3 of them, and it's essentially once a month and sometimes twice.
Okay.
But essentially, we're getting the rhythm down. And long story short, like, the response has been wonderful. It's been growing each and every time. And it's just a really wonderful event full of kids. And it's intergenerational. There are older people, younger people, and it's just really genuine and intentional.
Okay. Well, I'm going to move over to Miss Janelle Fish.
Thank you.
You know I speak French, right?
Yeah, clearly.
Yeah. French bread, French toast, French fries.
French fries, yeah.
So, tell us, the attendees can enjoy a fresh cooked meal and take books home from our donated collection of Who Speaks on specific topics. So expand on that a little bit.
Sure. Well, I'm talking as a volunteer for Books and Breakfast. So I've come to help set up the meal. So the fresh cooked meal is just like Ada said, it's breakfast. You get pancakes, bagels, eggs, there was sausage and bacon and fresh fruit, and so it's a nice spread, all for free.
Okay.
And then each time there are tables set up at the Boys and Girls Club with books for people to take. So if someone sees something of interest to them, there's children's books, adult books, fiction, nonfiction, really something for everybody, but all Black authors. And so it's really targeted to the community, and promoting literacy. So it's just, I think it's an incredible blend of everything all in one space. And like Ada said, it's intergenerational. So, you know, like, I bring my son with me when I volunteer, and he hangs out and plays basketball and looks at the books and colors. And
I'm a firm believer, readers become leaders, and learners become earners.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, you know? For real.
So tell us about them. The event also features a local author who reads excerpts from their book, or local guest who speaks on specific topics.
Yeah, so again, I mean, maybe Ada is better to speak to this, but I've seen one of the authors speak, and please tell me her name.
I know.
It was the children's book author.
Yeah, oh my God.
I don't know. This past month, but the previous month, there was this incredible author who's writing this children's book, and she spoke, and it was like listening to music for 20 minutes. I mean, she just talked about her writing and the purpose behind it in a way that I think engaged everybody, but there's more people coming, right? You guys are planning more speakers?
Oh, yeah. Essentially, the focus is definitely on local authors, because believe it or not, there are a lot of people locally that have created their own books, and it's an opportunity for them to talk about their work and reach an additional audience. We've had, like she was talking about, the children's book author. We've also had someone called Tef Poe, who came from Boston, who's also a social activists in that area, and it was great hearing him talk about his work. And basically, it was a way for people to learn about social justice as well as learn about a local author for them to engage with. Because my thing is this, like, a lot of people don't know, still, even whether they're from here or not, a lot of people still don't know how great this area is and the people that make it great. So for someone to come to an event like that and learn about a local author, they're like, wow, I had no idea.
Yeah, and I try to have a local, I try to give awareness and exposure to a lot of local authors, and because I think it's so important, or just in general, the shining stars we have in the Capital District.
Oh, gosh,
my last art author was, she was 10 years old. Yeah,
beautiful.
And she won an award. She wrote an essay at her school, and they published her article. Mm-hmm. And she was on the guest or on the show, and then she came back and gave me a signed autograph or autograph book. And she spoke again, and that was just phenomenal. And right here in the 518 area.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me about CDIF and collaborating with Troy-based Helens Against Racism.
All right, okay. So I'm here representing Helens Against Racism, which is really just a creative label we've made up for a group of white women on Facebook. So I'm just going to call it what it is.
All right, a group of white women on Facebook. All right.
So there was a group, and maybe some of your listeners will know about it. Maybe they're in it, but it's called Helens of Troy, and it's a Facebook group that is comprised of primarily white women living.
Why white women?
That's just the bubble, right?
Okay, gotcha.
So the bubble.
That's where you start, the guy.
The bubble expanded, and we looked around one day and realized it's really white. The bubble was inhabited by women of color. That it's not to say it was exclusively white women or that women of color were left out.
Mm-hmm.
But what ended up happening several months ago was a dialogue began in this secret group that you needed to be invited into that became really difficult. And it was centered around race and white women not really being able to see race.
Okay.
Because they don't have to.
Right.
And women of color entering the conversation and saying, wait a minute, I'm not sure you're really looking out for us in the same way that you think you are.
Okay.
So long story short, a group of us broke off and created another group called Helens Against Racism. And we've been trying to pull together real tangible initiatives to kind of do this work and unpack white privilege, start to examine racism and how we can do it differently.
Great.
So that's where we linked up with Dee Dee and Ada and the Capital District Intersectional Feminists to partner and bring author Debbie Irving to Troy for a 2-day workshop on anti-racism.
We're going to get to probably if not in this segment, the next segment. So then speak to me about the bookshop was created to take responsibility of racial education. Which one of you want to speak to that?
Oh, yeah, I could talk about
it.
So, yes, there is a woman named Debbie Irving, and she is a racial justice educator from Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
And before that happened, she was just a regular teacher.
Okay.
And when she went back
this was just thrown upon her. She didn't walk in it. She didn't look for it,
no,
right?
Basically, it was something that happened in her life that became her calling. And I'm sure when she does this workshop in a couple of weeks, she'll expand so beautifully on it. But I'm paraphrasing here.
Mm-hmm.
So this woman, Debbie Irving, she was just a regular teacher out in Boston and or Massachusetts, I should say. And one day, you know, she realized she wanted to go back to school for her master's. And so she ended up taking a class on like racism and history. And she learned so much about herself and the ways of the world in terms of racial injustices. Like, it was essentially, what's the word? It was like an epiphany for her. And the catharsis involved her creating the book she wished existed when she was a young educator. Because essentially, she realized how much she didn't know about racism and how it affected people of color.
Okay.
And before she knew it, she was like, I have to write a book. And she just birthed this book called Waking Up White. And it was written in about 2015. And ever since it's been written, it's been a literal bombshell in academic and social settings in regards to how white people perceive race outside of themselves.
Okay. Well, I'm going to have to bring you guys back for another segment because this is so much information that I want to bring awareness and exposure to. So will you promise me you'll come back?
Sure.
Okay, then good. And so I'm going to close this out, but I want to say thank you guys for showing up. I appreciate what you've done. I appreciate what you're doing, and I appreciate what you're going to do, okay? And I'm going to be looking forward to the next segment, and we're going to talk more and dig in deeper on this topic, okay?
Thank you.
All right, then. Okay, then. So as I always end, until next time, folks, it's about the triple E's, education, empowerment, entrepreneurship. And remember this. Don't hear about making a difference. You need to be about making a difference. This is Inez Bosch's baby boy and your overcoming adversity specialist, H. Bosch Jr., doing what I'm made to believe. Okay, okay. That was Zanelle Fish and Ada Harper from the Capital District Intersectional Feminist Group discussing their work in this weekend's upcoming Waking Up White seminar at the Troy YWCA. Real quick, special thanks to the Honorable DeQuetta Patrice Jones, a.k.a. Awesome, Executive Director of the Troy YWCA, for hosting.
For those just tuning in, I'm Amy Loria.
And I'm H. Bosch Jr. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
April 4th through 6th, scores of community leaders, scholars, and elected officials gathered in Newark, New Jersey for a national emergency summit on gentrification. Convened by the Institute of the Black World 21st Century, the summit focused on reversing and overcoming the displacement of black people and black culture caused by the devastating impact of gentrification. In this segment, Hudson Mohawk Magazine roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry will play recorded excerpts from this meeting, highlighting comments by Newark Mayor Roz J. Baraka.
Mayor Roz Baraka.
So I want to thank and give honor to Ron Daniels. Let's do that, please. Ron Daniels. Many people didn't know we've been having this. This is maybe our second or third time. This is our third time here in the city of Newark, and bringing people from all over the country to debate and talk about issues, right? Doesn't mean we necessarily agree all the time, but we have the courage to debate and discuss, right? And that's important. We're talking about decades of gentrification that was pointed out that took place years before most of you were even born. We're talking about stuff that began post-World War II when they began to defund or de-invest in these communities, draw circles around them, subsidize people to go to the suburbs, right? Begin to create these roads, as Larry pointed out, so people can get wealth in the community and go out and live in the suburbs at the same time. They purposefully disinvested in these neighborhoods purposely. And they created these things where they came in and said they're going to invest in the community to knock land down and left the land barren for years. So you got a bunch of vacant lots that have been in your community. You thought they came there yesterday. They've been there since 1950. Since 1967. They tore whole slots of land down, right? And disinvested in that community. And so now there's no wealth in your community. And this whole idea that gentrification has a color is not true. It's not true. Gentrification is a part of a market force that exists in capitalism, which means that if the low-income housing in Manhattan is $3,000, right, and I've been charging $700 on this side, those people who can't afford there are going to find their way to this side, right? And I can now not charge them $700, I can now charge them $1,700, $1,800, because I can get the rent. That's the market forces that control that, not individuals. The market controls that, and that is a primary function of capitalism. And so our job is to mitigate that. How do you get in the way of that to make sure that that doesn't crush people, that you're not throwing people out? Because guess what? When people say they came back to the community and it looked different, it should look different. Let me tell you why. I grew up in Newark, for real, right? We didn't have, when I came up, there was not even a sit-down restaurant in our neighborhoods. No, not even the ATM where you could get money from. Vacant lots, abandoned buildings, schools that were decrepit, housing that's been outdated for 30, 40 years. It should look different. Things should change, right? But the question is, how do they change, and where do you get the wealth from to change that? I think most of us have been focused on the downtown areas because what happens is when these cities come back, because they're trending back to the cities, people are saying, I want to move in the cities because it's hipper, it's next to the train station, all these things. They're trending back, so people are moving downtown. We have to figure out what do we need to do in our neighborhoods where we live. I don't live downtown. And most of us don't live downtown. And so while we're arguing about buildings they're creating downtown, your neighborhood looks a mess. And so what we need to be doing is trying to figure out how to extract wealth to get people to develop the neighborhoods and get minority and young developers to develop those things and own that property at the same time, right? That's what, so here's a few things. I had the pleasure of sitting in a meeting a week ago with three young African-American men who attend our men's meetings, right? They joined and formed a corporation at the meeting, right? They did it at the meeting. That's empowerment. I don't care what nobody's talking about. They did it at the meeting. And then I sat in a meeting with them, and they sat with other developers, big developers, and they identified three or four pieces of parcel that they're going to develop themselves. But because the city has something in their tax abatement law that says you have to have a minority co-developer, right, which means that you get equity in the property and not a subcontractor, they sat there at the table as the principal on the property because the other folks could not get the deal done unless they were in the room. And that's the condition that you create. And while you yelling and screaming, those three boys are building in their community, and they're going to be able to build property in the neighborhoods where they were born and raised, right? And you want to fight gentrification? Own some damn property. See, co-ops and collective ownership and ownership, period, is the beginning of how you begin to stop gentrification, right? You have to begin to stop it. And so when people talk about inclusionary is a tool. That's not an end-all, be-all. It's a tool. It's a tool designed, especially if you have what the sister said, an affordable housing trust fund. Because guess what? Our people not moving downtown. I don't care how long you fight or march, they're not coming down here. They don't want to be down here. Their families are too big to be down here, first of all, right? They have real families. They're not millennials who live by themselves, came from college, or, you know, bankers from Wall Street, or these guys. They don't want to live downtown. They want to live in their neighborhood. They just don't want to live next to vacant lots and dirty buildings and unsafe conditions. They want their neighborhood fixed up. Our job is to extract wealth from what they're doing downtown and force them to put it in the communities where people live at through affordable housing trust funds to get those young three brothers who are gonna build those property. And they may have a gap in their financing to take that money and put it in the gap in their financing so they have a full project and tell them we need them to pay or charge this amount of rent for their property. The other piece is to have a land bank or a land trust. When the state of New Jersey finishes passing a land bank, the city of Newark begins to create its own land bank that we're waiting in the wings to do. The land bank allows us to control the property that we have and begin to use it for things that we think it should be used for and not giving it out to speculators who come into to these auctions and buy all this property up and then flip it and sell it at exorbitant prices. The land bank allows us to control it. Then you partner the land bank with a land trust. The land trust allows us to identify parts of the city and say this part of the city is going to be affordable in perpetuity. So we get to say from this block to that block will always be affordable no matter what at this price. We get to do those things, but you have to have a mind to build to be able to make those things take place. The other piece is you need rent control. Now I hear people yelling, no, we need rent control. Newark has had rent control for a long time. We've had it for a long time. When I was a legislator, we strengthened the rent control. When I became the mayor, some people organized and they strengthened it even more. So we have one of the strongest rent control ordinances in the nation right here in the city of Newark. There's some other ways that landlords navigate around it and try to not be involved in it by not registering their properties and doing all kinds of things. That just means we have to be aggressive. I'm arguing when people say, oh, the rent control ordinance is bad because the landlords are not registered. Well, damn it, help me register them. Get you and your organization to come out with me. What you want to meet, have a meeting about that. We're going to get together. We're going to get 15 of us. We're going to walk down this block. We're going to identify all the buildings that ain't registered. We're going to call the city and say, these not registered. And we're going to make them get on the registry. And this is the money that they owe. That's what we're going to do. That's revolutionary action and activism. Not sitting there saying, oh, the buildings are not registered. Look at you, look at you, look at you. It means get off your laurels, get yourself in the community, knock on some doors, and say these buildings are not registered. Get these buildings registered. That's what you should be doing. That's fundamentally what should be happening. Listen, our fundamental job after rent control, after all of those other pieces that I talked about, is also necessary for us to make sure that people in our community have wealth. They have to have wealth. If they don't have wealth, then there's no self-determination. You can't determine your own destiny without no resources. If you don't have no resources, you don't have no destiny. If you don't have no wealth in your house, how are your kids going to eat? You got to go to the bread line to get food from somebody else. Right? If you don't have a decent education, you're always going to be dependent on other people to do for you what you should be doing for yourself. Right? And so it's important for us to build wealth in our community. That's why that's important. It's important. And the brother said something very, very deep about diverting funding from police agencies to other organizations. He pointed out Erica Ford, who just told me they're getting $36 million in New York City funds that was diverted to do street organizing in their community. And I know her when she was organizing and protesting. She took that to turn it into something real, to give people some real opportunity in their community and keep them alive longer, to tell them we need at least 1% to 5% of your funding to be diverted to a fund that'll fund these organizations to do alternative police work in our community. This gentrification thing is difficult, folks. I just want you to know that. It's difficult. If it was as simple as we could wave our hand and the stuff go away, guess what? There'd been a lot of hands waved already. This is a difficult thing, especially in communities that have no resources, who depend on people to come there and dump resources on them. They hope they can make a deal with them, right? And that they would do that, and most of the time they don't do what they say they was gonna do. And so you spend your time trying to fight them for years to get them to do something that they had no intention on doing in the first place. So we have to find opportunities to create wealth for ourselves so we can do the things ourselves what we're depending on other people to do for us, right? You can be angry and mad all you want. What you need to do is be organized. Bobby Ture said, organize, organize, organize. If you ain't in an organization, you go out there and yell and scream at the wall if you want. You got to be a part of an organization, and guess what? You by yourself is not an organization. And you going to meetings yelling by yourself is not an organization. Organize, and tweeting ain't no damn organization either. I'm going to sit down.
That was roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry with highlights from the National Summit on Gentrification featuring Newark Mayor Roz J. Baraka in part two of his segment, Labor Talk.
Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Imani Taylor shares with us the 13th installment of her ongoing segment on technology. This week, she interviews retired architect and friend of the station, Joe Fama.
Hi, this is Hudson Mohawk Network correspondent Imani Taylor, and I'm here with an old friend of the sanctuary, Joe. Thank you for coming here. How are you, Joe?
Very well. Thank you for having me.
Could you tell me a little bit about yourself? What do you do for work? What are some of your hobbies?
Yes, I am still a licensed architect, although I'm retired from active practice. And hobbies, I don't have any. Gardening, gardening is my... And still, I'm involved with the sanctuary. And I used to run the community land bank. I'm still with the community land bank on a couple of projects. And for 43 years, I ran TAP Incorporated, and I'm happily still there from time to time, working on one thing or another. It's like most people who retired. I'm as more busy than I wanted to be, and happy, but happily retired.
If you don't mind my asking, or if you don't mind sharing, how old are you?
In 2 weeks, I'll be 71.
Wow. So would you say you grew up in the computer era?
Oh, gee, no.
What does that mean to you when I say that?
Well, when you, for example, I would say the computer era, to me, is the period of time when all of a sudden virtually every desk had a computer on it. By the time I graduated college, which was because I was an architect, it was 1971 I graduated college. I think at that point there was still only one computer on campus. It was in a room in the Amos Eaton, and it was a great big computer. And I took one course in computer programming when I was in college, and I actually was typing punch cards. And I studied Fortran and learned how to write a program. And I learned it wasn't for me. Never bothered with it again. And most of the people in my architecture class who became architects don't even use the computer for computer-assisted drafting, for CAD work. They hire people, younger people like yourself, who are more comfortable around a computer to do that. And mm-hmm. and I made that decision in when I was running TAP that I wasn't going to bother to learn CAD drafting because I think I just was too old to really make that adjustment. I do use a computer now all the time. Mm-hmm. I could spend a whole day doing Photoshop. I love Photoshop. I find Excel to be a tremendous asset to work with mm-hmm. and stuff like that. So I do use the computer, but I'm barely scratching the surface of it today. So, yeah, and the story I want to tell. Oh, do you have more questions before I get into my boring story?
Just for those who don't know, what is TAP?
TAP is the actual name of it is TAP Incorporated, and it's Detroit Architectural Program. And it's to make a very loose analogy, it's a little bit like an architectural version of legal aid. We try to provide design services to people in the city of Troy and very definitely want to try and reach out to organizations like the Sanctuary and people like the folks who live in this neighborhood, who especially those that want to fix up a building for themselves and to provide the architectural services for them at the lowest possible cost that we can so that people can work on their own buildings in their own neighborhoods. And it's very gratifying work. I enjoyed my opportunity to do that for all those years.
So you can go ahead. I'm very intrigued with the story you have to tell.
Well, I can't tell you what year it is, but you can post-figure it out because it was the year that St. Helens blew, the volcano in the northwest corner of the United States. Mount St. Helens was a volcano that blew into a tremendous explosion. I mean, it was a major volcanic eruption. TAP is one of many community design centers that are neighborhood-based. Many of them are university-based projects, almost always involved with architecture students and some combination of design assistance and social welfare kinds of projects throughout the country. And at the time this story occurred, Apple was just beginning to spread its wings. Apple had made kind of a big splash, and they were starting to give away computers to create networks that so people could all over the country could talk to one another. And there was a group called the Community Design Assistance Center or something like that. It was a coalition of groups like ours in Troy. There was one in Berkeley, there was one in North Carolina, there was one in Mississippi, there was one in Philadelphia, another one in Pittsburgh. There were a dozen, probably two dozen at the time, community design centers. And Apple gave us all a computer. This was so long ago, it was before there were Macs. So this might mean something to somebody else, but I think we got 2G or 2Es. That was the name of the computer. It was a way old computer, but it had the capacity to communicate with all these other computers because it was the beginnings of they were trying to promote the internet. And what happened was that we didn't use it at all as a network because each community design center had its own state, its own code department, its own architectural problems. And there was very little that we talked about on a regular basis. So it just never developed as a network. But we were very grateful to have the computer because all of a sudden we had a computer to write letters with. It was the first computer. We were dazzled. So all of a sudden Mount St. Helens erupted. Mm-hmm. And the thing goes nuts. I start getting input, not just from community design centers, but from everybody, like from all over the country. I start getting this information coming into us about Mount St. Helens. And I'm looking at it, and there are people writing that Mount St. Helens was a conspiracy, that somehow this was, I don't know, whatever your point of view was, if you believed the communists were bad, you thought it was a communist conspiracy. If you thought the communists were good, you thought it was a right-wing conspiracy. It was like, it was a volcano, for God's sake. And I turned to my wife, who was our office administrator, and I said, Barbara, we've just gotten in contact with every lunatic in America. And I have never quite shaken that sense of what that's what the internet is, an opportunity mm-hmm. to listen to every aberrant set of thoughts that mm-hmm. people have all over the world. And the older it gets, the more it seems to me that's the way the internet is. That's my story of my introduction to the internet.
That's a great story. So I want to ask you, you talked about the big old clunky computers.
Yep.
Now we have computers that can fit in our pockets.
Yes.
Do you have a smartphone?
I do. But the only reason I have a smartphone is because my flip phone broke.
So that was another question I was going to ask, is how do you use your phone differently now than you did any older phone? And talking about the internet as being a way to listen to everyone.
I'm going to tell you the truth. I'd rather have my flip phone. I don't use my smartphone. I like having it for a camera. Mm-hmm. I like having the weather. Mm-hmm. I have virtually no apps on it. And I see people all over the place who seem to have their head on into their smartphone for 80% of their day, mm-hmm. as near as I can see. I mean, if you get on a bus, 80% of the people are looking at their smartphones. Mm-hmm. And that's just not how I was used to living my life. And I can remember, too, many years after the story I told, when everybody at our office at TAP had a computer on their desk. And some of the people there who were 20 years younger than me, I thought of them as, you know, young people who knew computers. And they were old enough to say, I didn't want to spend my whole life in front of a computer. I want to be out in the field. I want to see people building things. I want to meet with clients. Mm-hmm. I don't just want, you know, to do the CAD drafting here. I'm interested in doing more than that. And I was surprised, but it's a remarkable tool. I'm not blind to that. It's an amazing, remarkable tool. Like all things with that much power, it can get ugly real fast. And it can take your whole life away. And worse, it could be used for bad ends. I'm fighting it. I'm literally not just not trying. I'm trying not to spend more than an hour a day on my smartphone.
All right. Well, we're pushing on time here.
Okay.
And that's really all I wanted to ask you.
Well, thanks very much. It was kind of fun.
Thank you for coming, Joe.
All right. That was Imani Taylor with Joe Fama for her ongoing technology series. I'll just say this, gone but never, never forgotten, my friend. All right, our next guest is, and we are so honored, it is a true honor and privilege to have Miss Ellen Rocco, station manager of the North Country Public Radio Station. Welcome, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Okay, well, tell us what brings you to the sanctuary tonight.
So Steve Pierce and I have known each other for some time, and this is my second time at the sanctuary to lead a workshop. Last year, I led a workshop on basic best practices of journalists.
Okay.
Tonight's workshop, which begins in about 10 minutes, I guess, is on interviewing techniques and kind of storytelling, too, I think, storytelling for radio. North Country Public Radio serves the third of New York State that used to be the fold over on paper maps because nobody ever went there. So we serve a third.
They went through there on the way to Canada, right?
You got it. Exactly.
Right.
So we serve a third of New York State, which sounds like really impressive, right? But it's mostly trees. Mm-hmm. And we have to do it with 34 transmitters. Because of the mountains.
Right.
It includes the Adirondack Mountains. It's quite a project for our engineer, known as Radio Bob. So I'm here to talk about interviewing, I guess, and just talk about basic skills. But what we talk about at North Country Public Radio is telling stories. We see our work as a way of telling stories. And an interview is one of the ways to tell a story. To allow people who you're interested in or have something interesting to say to tell a particular story. There are two kinds of interviews to my mind. One is the news interview. Mm-hmm. When you go to the town board or the county legislature and you interview one of the elected officials about a particular issue or a bill that's pending, and you're looking for essentially facts, cold, hard information is what you're really looking for to share with your audience and then let them decide if they like the way the person is going to vote or not. Mm-hmm. And then there's storytelling interviewing where you might be interested in what someone does and you want to know mm-hmm. more about who they are and what they do. And that's how I kind of divide interviews very roughly.
Okay. So tell us a little bit about your background, where you're from, your personal background.
I was born in Manhattan.
Okay.
And
forgive you.
it's funny because my son, as soon as he could, moved directly to Manhattan from the farm he grew up on.
Okay.
I was nice part of what's known as the Back to the Land movement, and I bought a farm in 1970, and I am still there.
Bless your heart twice.
Over the years, I've raised sheep, draft horses, chickens, turkeys, big garden, that sort of thing. And I've been station manager of North Country Public Radio since 1985. I started in 1980 as kind of Jill of all trades, development director, documentarian, et cetera. And now I've been station manager, these many years.
Okay.
What have you learned? What are some of your favorite things that you've learned in the years?
I'd say the big one, and I might have said this to Steve the other night when he chatted with me briefly, is that you think you know people.
How about that? Can't wait for this. All right.
I have yet to meet someone who hasn't surprised me.
Hmm.
People are full of surprises.
I like that.
And that, in a way, is what an interview is all about. Finding that surprising, interesting thing that someone has to share. That they're a carpenter, and then it turns out, they also go home at night and knit like award-winning sweaters or something. Mm-hmm. I mean, you just never know what people have hidden.
Right. One of my favorite questions when I'm conducting an interview, I always ask my interviewee, tell us something that most people would be surprised to know about you. Is that good?
That's exactly it.
I'm so happy.
And sometimes you pick up on it indirectly. Someone will be talking about, let's say, the carpenter is talking about the house he just built or that he was renovating. And while he was rooting around, he found a stash of old yarn or something. And I might say, you have to be listening.
Right.
You have to say, well, why is that of interest to you?
Right.
Or whatever. You have to pay really close attention to what people say when you interview.
So did you have any formal training or you just kind of fell into this once you brought a farm, you bought the farm, or as they say, I bought the farm.
Boy,
this is just taking on a life of its own, right, this interview. See, this has turned out to be a great interview. Yep, because I'm a firm believer interviews should be conversations, not interviews, because interviews can be too mechanical. But when I always tell people when you come on, we're just going to have a conversation, all right, and it might turn into an interview, but my big thing is I just want to talk to you.
Sure.
Yeah. So,
I agree.
How did you wind up buying the farm, so to speak, and moving into radio?
Well, I'm of that generation that kind of created what we think of now as public radio. It kind of got created in the 70s, and it came into maturity in the 80s and 90s. And so we were totally by the seat of our pants. Mm-hmm. It was a lark. And it wasn't until we were involved in some natural disasters reporting, keep people connected to each other, 9/11, that we realized that there's a very, very serious side to the work we do. And so we have fun, but we also take it seriously.
Okay. Well, Ms. Rocco, we're going to have to close it down, but I'm
going
to say you're going to come back. You're part of the WOOC family.
Well,
and
thank
it has
you.
Been a plum pleasing pleasure to have you on as a guest tonight.
Thanks so much.
God
great talking with you.
Thank
success.
You very much.
Okay. All right.
All right, well.
So that concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm your host, H. Bosch Jr.
And I'm Amy Loria. Our engineer tonight is Alexis Goldsmith.
Go, Alexis.
Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
Okay. As a reminder, Hudson Mohawk Radio Network is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in volunteering with our radio effort, shoot us an email at infomediasanctuary.org or just stop by one of our weekly meetings on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m. held right here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Until next time, folks, you know the voice. This is H. Bosch Jr. Thank you for tuning in.